Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the American Jewish Experience Part 5, Business and Finance. And we're sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ili Nishmat Yona, Ben Harav Aryeh Leib, his neshama should have, and Aliyah. It's undeniable and frankly astonishing that Jews have been an economic success story in America, arguably greater than any other immigrant group. Look no further than the extraordinary success of many Holocaust survivors, many of whom came without families, and all of whom came with nothing. So while it's by no means true of all, it's indisputable that many arrived on American shores and within a decade or two achieved enormous prosperity, literally rags to riches. Books have been written on the phenomenon. Some attributed their success to the resourcefulness that was often a prerequisite to survival. It's not absolute, of course. Many resourceful Jews were also murdered by the Nazis, Hashem Yikom Damam, but it made them more daring and more likely to think out of the box and take risks. But what was largely true for survivors is also largely true of American Jews generally. American Jews as a group are in the highest economic bracket. A third of American billionaires are Jews, roughly calculated at about 250 out of 750 billionaires, although the numbers are fluid. Market goes up, there are more. Market goes down, there are fewer. But a third are Jews. That's not normal, seeing as we're less than 2% of the population. Jews are 20% of the world's billionaires, while numbering just 0.02% of the world population. That's not normal. And similar proportions would pertain to the number of Jewish millionaires. And of course, this issue and this topic play into the narrative of our enemies, who see Jews as controlling all the wealth, the business, the banks, the insurance companies, the manufacturing, the media, etc. So we're attacked because of our success. The persecution is unjustified, but the stereotype, for the most part, is true. We are more financially successful. But why should that be? So before we get to know how American Jews have shaped business and finance in the United States, it's important to understand why that is. Because, truth be told, it's been like that in every generation and on every continent in which we have lived. For that matter, it's true now in the state of Israel as well, which is a remarkable success story. Even in Europe, where most Jews were suppressed and most could not even own land, there were Jews who were also very prosperous. Merchants in timber, fur, tea, bankers, financiers, middlemen, brokers. Jews entered retail because we were denied the right to be in real estate and often could not do any manufacturing either. But why has it turned out that Jews have always been disproportionately wealthy? Of course, there are plenty of poor Jews also. Always be poor Jews. But as a proportion of the population, we are atypical. So why is that? Rav Kook commented on this in a number of places because it's a recurring theme in the Torah. One place you'll see in his commentary, Ein Hayah on Brachot, in the first parak, it's Siman Kuf Yud Dalet. Note that all the Avot were extremely wealthy, a point that the Torah doesn't elide, but in fact underscores, just as we're taught that Moshe was independently wealthy. To this week's Sedra, in fact, Psolet lecha. You can have the chips of the precious stone of which the Luchot were made. That's your wealth. The Kohen Gadol had to be Gadol Me'echav, wealthier than all the other Kohanim. And if he wasn't when he took office, he had to be enriched by them. And the greatest proof is really from Yetziat Mitzrayim, from the Exodus, where God told Avram the very beginning that we would be enslaved be'eretz lo lohem, in a land not theirs, and then va'acharei chen yitzu berchush gadol, will leave Egypt or that unknown land with great riches. B'mamon gadol, Rashi says. And that is exactly what happened. The day before the redemption, we went house to house in Egypt, borrowing, so to speak, klei chesef v'klei zahav, all their silver, all their gold, to the extent that the Torah says, vayinatzlu et Mitzrayim, we cleaned out Egypt of all its wealth. All right, they had it coming to them for enslaving us, but why is this important? So Rav Kook explained that there are two reasons. One was l'romem et ruach ha'am, to lift the spirit of the people. See, here in Egypt, we'd been lowly slaves. Overnight, we became wealthy, that we should not internalize the inferiority that the Egyptians had imposed upon us. It wasn't just a question of injustice, of feeling aggrieved for working without compensation. That's a moral issue. But this is a psychological one. We would not be able to yearn for greatness unless we saw ourselves as great people, not as victims and not as slaves. So that's the first reason, l'romem et ruach ha'am. There's a second reason, and this applies to the Avot as well, and it's a practical reason. The world respects wealth. People listen more carefully to people who have money, even if it's not always justified. They listen more carefully. So the nations of the world want to draw near to us if we have money. Our truth seems more appealing. If the Jewish people were unsuccessful and impoverished and considered losers rather than chosen, we could never be an Or LaGoyim, a light unto the nations. We can't be a light if people have no interest in flicking our switch. So both reasons still pertain. With all the horrors of the exile, if the depredations were compounded by abject, relentless poverty, it would have been unbearable. So even despite the grinding poverty that was the fate of most Jews in the Pale of Settlement, even there was most, but not all, there are wealthy Jews there also. And even Jews who weren't wealthy experienced a sort of wealth, psychologically, every Shabbat, when we dressed in our finest clothing and were able to skimp and save to put a respectable meal on the table. It's no wonder why Jews never developed an inferiority complex, much to the consternation and dismay of our enemies. And similarly, money gives us a seat at the table and makes people want to hear what we have to say. And that really is the influence of Jews in politics that we'll discuss next time. We don't have the numbers in the United States, but Jews do direct a substantial amount of money towards their favorite, usually Democrat, candidates. Do they like our ideas? Often we have bad ideas, but they like our money. And that's why we have a seat at the table. At least they'll be open to what we have to say, because we succeed in a venue which they admire. And so if they draw near to us because we're successful, as Rav Kook put it, yesh tikva ki yakiru hod ha'emet, there's hope that they'll recognize the majesty of our truth as well. Part of the mystery of the Jew that captures the imagination of the nations, sometimes their fear, is this point. How is it that we are disproportionately successful wherever we are and whenever we have lived? Indeed, Birkat Hashem Hitashir. I don't doubt at all, it's not only a divine blessing, but it's a purposeful divine blessing. And that's why Jews have always had this mystique. We have it to this day. So how have Jews influenced business and finance in America? So if you look at the early years, one way that we indelibly molded American life was through the provision of specific goods and then general goods in a way that had never been done before. And this at first was a niche of German Jews. Let's look first at fashion. So one Jew, a particular Jew, his name is very famous, he came with his mother from Germany, from Buttenheim, and worked in the family dry goods store. He moved to California in the middle of the 19th century, and he became a large supplier of dry goods to the gold rushers in the 1840s and 1850s, clothing, tents, bedding, etc. His name was Levi Strauss, and he forever cemented his part in American culture when he teamed up with Jacob Davis, who was a Jewish tailor originally from Riga, to invent blue jeans. So it was meant to be working pants reinforced with copper rivets. So Davis invented it. Levi Strauss gave his financial support and lent his name to it as well. Levi's jeans, which was invented in the early 1870s and still exists. To his chagrin, Davis sold out way too early. It's impossible to conclude otherwise than that the American garment industry was largely a Jewish one, and certainly it was, as it was centered in New York. Jewish immigrants in the late 19th century brought with them from Europe unique tailoring skills that revolutionized the industry. So it's estimated that by 1910, New York City produced 70% of the nation's women's clothing and 40% of its men's clothing. And the people who did the work and owned the companies were disproportionately Jews. All right, this came at a cost. When a fire erupted at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, March 25th, 1911, 146 people were killed. Most of them were young Jewish women employees. The factory's Jewish owners were anti-union, but the fire, which killed almost 30% of the employees present that day, most of them on the ninth floor, whose escape doors were locked to prevent theft from outsiders and malingering by the employees, galvanized the labor movement in New York and across the country. The International Ladies Garment Workers Union, the ILGW, was already in existence. It was founded in 1900 by 11 Jewish men, but the fire strengthened it and expanded its influence, and also spearheaded the creation of what was called the New York State Committee on Safety, from which you can draw a straight line to OSHA today to deal with the safety, worker safety. Worker safety became an American concern because of what happened there. And elsewhere, there were sweatshops. In the sweatshops in New York, for example, pay was low, conditions were awful, and the hours were long. And people were easily exploited because they needed jobs. As one of the well-known Jewish journalists of the day, Abram Kahan, wrote about one worker in 1896, the worker said, "They say a day has 24 hours. That's a bluff. A day has 12 coats. I have still two coats to make of the 12 that I got yesterday. So it's still Monday with me. My Tuesday won't begin before about 2 o'clock this afternoon." And the truth is, any person who could buy a sewing machine for about $50 and set people to work in tenement apartments, low wages, produce low prices, which produce greater sales, but also horrible conditions for the workers. And all of this kickstarted the labor movement, which again was disproportionately populated by Jews. Among the people sent to New York City in the late 19th century to learn the garment business was one Julius Rosenwald, who was the son of wealthy German Jewish clothing manufacturers who lived in Springfield, Illinois. Rosenwald bought into a non-Jewish company that was started by a fellow named Richard Warren Sears and Alvin Curtis Roebuck in 1892 as a mail order company. Rosenwald joined the company as part owner a few years later, and he soon expanded Sears Roebuck into retail stores, and Rosenwald bought the others out. He made a fortune, and he was revered as a philanthropist who gave a lot of money. His specialty was giving money to black education, the education of black Americans. Sears was the largest retailer in America in the 1980s, and it had a good run of almost a century, but is now in bankruptcy. It wasn't only Rosenwald and Sears. Jews were the founders and owners of most of the famous department stores in America. Gimbel's, for example. Adam Gimbel, whose sons all entered the business, began each corporate meeting by reading and darshaning a pasuk from the book of Mishle, Proverbs. Macy's, founded by Isidore Strauss, who died on the Titanic. Filene's, I. Magnin, Neiman Marcus, Bloomingdale's, Bergdorf Goodman, Riches of Atlanta, Kaufman's of Pittsburgh, Lazarus of Columbus, Bamberger's started in Newark, Abraham and Strauss, B. Altman, and these in more recent times, Century 21, and many others as well. Not only that, it was Edward Filene who created Filene's Basement and the discount concept, and also brought credit unions to the United States. So blame him. These were all Jewish businesses. It was mostly the work of German Jewish immigrants. Look at the name, Bambergers, Gimbel, Strauss, etc. Indeed, by 1890, more than 90% of the lower New York factories were owned by German Jews. And just listen to the statistics. In 1910, Jews constituted 80% of the hat and cap makers, 75% of the furriers, 68% of the tailors, and 60% of the milliners. That is dominance of an industry. And add to them the more recent retailers like Sonny Gindi, who founded Century 21 with a few fellow Syrian Jews, Barney's, even Mo Ginsburg, where I bought a couple of suits over the years. And aside from the designers that we discussed last time, these Jewish clothing retailers are legends. Just think of the brands: BCBG, Max Azria, Spanx, Columbia Sportswear, American Apparel, Kenneth Cole, The Gap, Jordache, Guess, Reebok, Florsheim Shoes, Donna Karan, Liz Claiborne, who's a founder, co-founder, just died last week, Michael Kors, J. Crew, Calvin Klein, on and on and on. What brand doesn't have a Jewish fingerprint on it? Even Van Heusen, the shirt company, was the outgrowth of a shirt manufacturer named Rabbi Moshe Phillips, who linked up with a Dutchman, hence the name Van Heusen. A woman named, young woman named Lena Himmelstein came to America from Lithuania, married David Bryant, widowed pretty early in her marriage, and as a seamstress began to make lingerie out of her apartment. She applied for a bank loan to grow her business. Her name, Lena, was somehow misspelled, and she became not Lena Bryant, but Lane Bryant, manufacturer of maternity wear and other plus-size clothing. And add Victoria's Secret and that whole company that dominates the industry. Jews so commonly owned general goods stores across the South that they were known colloquially, without a trace of self-awareness or hatred, as Jew stores. People said, let's go to the Jew store, because the Jew store had everything. And Jews were instrumental in starting the textile industry in places as diverse as Greenville, North Carolina, and Massachusetts, and elsewhere in America. That's just one industry. Take another. I was surprised to learn how Jews have dominated the cosmetics industry. In 1930s California, a Jew developed a type of makeup that could be used with the new Technicolor film that Hollywood was introducing. His name was Frank Factor, but the company was his father's. His father's name was Maximilian Faktorovich. And when his father died, the son changed his name officially to Max Factor Jr. That's Max Factor. It was the father who even introduced the word makeup into the vernacular. And as a skilled beautician, he became known for giving Hollywood actresses their signature looks. And then the son parlayed that into a large company selling cosmetics until today. Charles Haskell Revson was not promoted to the company where he worked, so he founded his own company, Revlon. Samuel Rubin founded Fabergé. Lawrence Geld co-founded Clairol. Of course, Helena Rubinstein. And this woman was the only woman on Time Magazine's list of business geniuses of the 20th century. Born Josephine Esther Menzner, she became Estée Lauder, skin care, hair care, perfume, etc. So a bit of a strange individual. She once claimed descent from a European aristocracy. She was born in Queens, the daughter of immigrants from Hungary. But she began to work for her uncle, who was a chemist, at his skincare company. And then she branched out big time, Estée Lauder. Take another industry. Also, we don't think about it, but dominance. Toys. Not only was Toys R Us a Jewish company, but so many of the toy manufacturers were Jews. Lionel Trains, Mattel, Hasbro, Ideal, the teddy bear was founded by Jews. It wasn't, in fact, named after Teddy Roosevelt. Henry Orenstein was a survivor of Majdanek, as well as the Plaszow camp near Krakow, infamously ruled by the sadistic Amon Goth. After he came to America, he entered the toy business and he founded Topper Toys, Dawn, Susie Homemaker, and later the Transformers. And there are many, many others as well. Not surprisingly, Jews are into food, and American Jews developed some of the legendary products that we consume. Snapple, Starbucks, Kind Bars, Sara Lee, Dunkin' Donuts, Baskin Robbins, Haagen-Dazs, which was a name made up by Reuben Mattis. I happen to have met Reuben and his wife, Rose, Alema Shalom, many years ago. Big supporters of Israel, especially right-wing causes in Israel. As we know, there's an Israel-hating ice cream company based in Vermont whose name I won't utter. But if you eat too much ice cream and candy, we also invented Nutrisystem and SlimFast and Sweet and Low. These are all Jewish-made products. Strangely enough, we drink too. It was German Jews produced two famous beers, Pabst Blue Ribbon and Rheingold. And other Jews gave us Grey Goose Vodka and more recently the Monster beverages. We have kosher companies like Manischewitz and all treif companies like Hot Pockets, which is the first microwavable food, cheese, meat, they didn't really care. The latter was founded by Paul Mirage, an Iranian Jew who came to America as a teenager, and after working for several companies, he first introduced Belgian waffles to the U.S., and then he founded Hot Pockets. And yet, to this, Jews who made a name for themselves in the manufacturing of raw materials, electronic parts, radios, car antennas, etc. And many of these names became famous because not so much what they sold, but because they became great Jewish philanthropists. Charles Avnet became a big philanthropist in Long Beach. My kids years ago went to Camp Avnet. He sold the electronic parts, automobile parts. Morton Mandel, big philanthropist in Cleveland, Mandel Foundation. Textiles, paper, greeting cards, name a business, Jews are in it. Staples was founded by Jews, as was the Home Depot, at Costco as well, and on and on and on. Jews defined retail and then redefined it. And I'm sure I'm leaving out dozens and dozens of examples. I just want to interject. B. Samuel pointed out to me in the last lecture talking about Jews in American literature, so I did forget, okay, so I just do this, you know, on top of my head in research, I forgot Hermann Wouk, who was a very influential writer, American Jewish writer, and unlike the other two that I mentioned, always tried to portray Judaism in a positive light. So, as is well known, Jews have become most prominent in recent decades in the technology revolution. These, for the most part, are all Jewish-founded and run companies. Facebook, Google, Oracle, Dell, Bloomberg, Packard Bell, Compaq, Groupon, Zula, PayPal, even Microsoft, through its co-founder Steve Ballmer. These are all Jewish-developed companies. And these people have literally changed the world in which we live. Larry Ellison, Sergey Brin, Larry Page, Mark Zuckerberg, Michael Bloomberg, and others. So these were people with ideas, creative ideas, that brought products and services to us that we didn't know we needed. and now, for the most part, we can't live without. I'm happy, by the way, that Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos are not Jews, since they've had, in the recent past, morally challenging lives. Of course, some of the Jews have also. Take another example. Jan Koum came to the U.S. in 1992 as a teenage Jewish refugee from Ukraine with his mother and grandmother. 1992. Came as a kid. Fast forward 20 years, and he developed something called WhatsApp. He and his friend liked it because it sounded like what's up, and he sold it to Facebook for $19 billion. That's another Jewish invention. There's nothing particularly Jewish about any of this, except that, as we discussed before, the Jewish mind is oriented to creativity, to thinking out of the box, and that's at the very heart of the technology revolution. Could Gentiles have done it? Yeah, well, there are plenty of Gentiles, there are plenty of creative Gentiles. But the disproportionate influence of Jews is staggering. That's the good news. The bad news is that it plays into the narrative of Jewishness being just an ethnicity without any religious component. And many of the aforementioned innovators like Zuckerberg and Page and others are intermarried and have non-Jewish children whose Jewish identity will inevitably wither away. Similarly, most of them, Bloomberg is one exception, there are a few others, most of them have little formal involvement in the Jewish community, and the hobby of many, like Ballmer, for example, is owning professional sports teams. I mentioned briefly a few lectures ago, media. It's not going to please our enemies, but you can't please everybody. Media companies are dominated by Jews. We already discussed how CBS, William Paley, originally William Polinsky, NBC, David Sarnoff, they were all founded by Jews. And now even ABC, through Disney, has Jewish ownership. Robert Iger and before him Michael Eisner. Time Warner is run by Jews, as is Viacom, big media conglomerate in America, founded by Murray Rothstein, unknown to most people, but better known by his chosen name, Sumner Redstone. Note how Rothstein became Redstone. So they own multiple television and radio stations, publishing companies like Simon & Schuster and Prentice Hall, cable networks like MTV and Showtime. Another strange bird. Again, genius, very creative, strange bird. His life really ended in disgrace in 2020 at age 97. Sumner Redstone's Jewish wife divorced him for his infidelity after 52 years of marriage, and he started shacking up with a series of non-Jews, and then he was in protracted litigation for a decade and a half over the fate of his company with his daughter Shari and others, who claimed her father was not fully competent anymore. And as it turns out, he was succeeded as CEO of Viacom by Shari Redstone. But all his grandchildren are Jewish, and in a very odd twist, Shari Redstone's first husband was Rav Yitzchak Aaron Ira Korf, the Boston-based Rebbe of the Shvil Mezhebush Hasidim. He's also an attorney, and who today is one of the rabbis. He's considered the Rav Ruchani, something like that, of the great synagogue in Yerushalayim. One of his grandsons, one of Sumner Redstone's grandsons, Tyler Korf, is also Orthodox, a musmach like his father, and an attorney as well. Go figure, only in America. Rupert Murdoch is not Jewish, but some of the top executives at Fox and the Wall Street Journal are. It's a source of distress to Jew haters that Jews are overrepresented in the media. It's a source of distress to me also that they're not always a positive influence on society. That the recently disgraced head of CNN, formerly NBC, Jeff Zucker, is a Jew, is not surprising. It would have been surprising if someone in his position was not a Jew. Major publishers are Jews, although you wouldn't know because they didn't identify as that. They just were Jews. Walter Annenberg became an ambassador, later a close friend of Ronald Reagan, founded TV Guide, billionaire. S.I. Newhouse, Condé Nast and the New Yorker, the Oxen-Sulzberger family, New York Times, David Pecker, National Enquirer, Us Weekly, Simon & Schuster, Random House, Rolling Stone, Mort Zuckerman, U.S. World Report. The list is endless. It's not widely known, but Joseph Pulitzer himself was a Jew. He was born 200 kilometers from Budapest. He became the publisher of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the New York World, was renowned for covering crime, scandal, sensational news stories, and really starting a whole genre in journalism, hence the Pulitzer Prize. Apropos of this topic, Jews were also disproportionately represented in the advertising industry, which also rewards creativity. The industry founder, Edward Bernays, was a nephew of Sigmund Freud and a great-grandson of Rav Isaac Bernays, who was the chief rabbi of Hamburg and one of the rebbeim of Rav Shamshon Ofarel Hirsch. So Edward Bernays is widely known as the first public relations man. He literally started an industry. He's known as the father of spin. But many of the top ad agencies were also founded by Jews. I think in modern times, Jews have made a tremendous impact in the world of real estate for reasons we'll discuss in a moment. I think real estate provides an especially useful insight into Jewish success in business in America, considering how Jews in Europe were largely banned from owning land and so became merchants and traders. But in America, land ownership was open to anybody. It was a classic business in which a person could start small and grow. Starting small meant buying one property and then using those proceeds to take out loans and buy other properties. And the genius of real estate is the opportunity to buy assets using other people's money, meaning loans from a bank. And if it works, that is to say, there's not a bad asset that eats away at your portfolio, or for some reason you cannot take out more loans, you just continue to buy and to build. Take one example out of many. Morris Milstein was an immigrant from Russia to the Bronx. He became a floor scraper, talking now the early 1900s. Within a few years, he founded a wood flooring company. Decades later, he founded a vinyl floor tile company, which his sons sold in 1959 for $24 million. This, again, from an immigrant, lived in the Bronx, a floor scraper. One son went into the floor tile business with him, and then he and his brother, and now I'm talking about Seymour Milstein and Paul Milstein, they ventured into real estate, soon buying properties all over Manhattan, and they became philanthropists as well. For example, Presbyterian Hospital, right near the George Washington Bridge, has the Milstein Building. Other Jews also started small. They bought a two-family house, lived in one, rented the other with the proceeds, bought other buildings, and so forth. Some names are legendary for their social impact. Also Jews, take William Levitt, who after World War II built what became known as Levittown, middle-class homes for returning veterans. He's widely known as the father of suburbia. Samuel Lefrak, then his son Richard Lefrak. I think they like to be called Lefrak, as if, you know, they're French. They built affordable housing in Queens, and then Jersey City, then Florida, Lefrak City in Queens. Jews were instrumental not only in building New York, but Jews were the leading developers in Miami, Chicago, Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Kansas City, San Francisco, Los Angeles, all Jews. And there are other cities too. Names like Wilf, Maclow, Calico, Chappelle, Zell, Zeckendorf, Zuckerman, Glazer, Kushner, Reinsdorf, Bob Kraft owns the Patriots, Stephen Ross owns the Dolphins, Larry Silverstein, Tishman, Speyer, Felt, the Felt Forum, Helmsley, and many of these people became even more famous for the sports teams or media companies they then purchased. Some were Sfardim, Moynihan, Ben Arroya, Hakim, Manasherian, Sutton, Tawil, Shetrit, Dweck. Some were Hasidim, Goldman, Moskowitz, Dushinsky, Schreiber. I've omitted hundreds, and not intentionally. It's hard to walk in Manhattan, for example, and see the plaques that adorn the buildings at ground level and not see Jewish names. So for sure, some of them ran into legal and other problems, but the industry itself is Jewish dominated. Yeah, there's some famous non-Jewish real estate families in New York as well. One happens to be named Trump, but as he once said in his sort of awkward, indelicate way, he wants only people with yarmulkes handling his money. And he meant it as a compliment. Similarly, Jews were pioneers in the shopping mall business that revolutionized American retail. The largest owner of shopping malls in America today is the Simon Property Group. It was founded by brothers Melvin Simon and Herbert Simon, who grew up also in the Bronx, the sons of a tailor. They own malls, or they're dead now, but the company does, in over a dozen countries and almost 40 states, including in New York, for example, Roosevelt Field, the Shops at Nanuet, Woodbury Common. In New Jersey, the Shops at Riverside, Livingston Mall, Jersey Shore Outlets. In Florida, the Town Center in Boca Raton, Aventura Mall in Florida. I only mention these because I've been there, probably close to 100 malls in all. All this was started by, built by a Jewish company. And then the Gurmazians, or religious Jews, Canadians, living now in New York for the most part, Iranian origin, they built and own the three largest malls in America. The West Edmonton Mall, which was the biggest. I visited there a number of years ago. I mean, it's like amazing. Olympic pool, Olympic skating rink, waterfall. It takes days just to walk through the entire mall. The Mall of America in Bloomington, and now American Dream finally open in East Rutherford, New Jersey. There's some real estate moguls like Joseph Wilf, who founded Garden Homes with his brother Harry, were Holocaust survivors. Jonah Goldrich in L.A., Tibor Holo in Miami, many more in New York and New Jersey. And if you think about it, these types of businesses, real estate and retail, were ideal for Jews because the professions, medicine, law, banking, were mostly off limits, or at least participation in them was limited because of quotas. And especially survivors were successful. About a third of Holocaust survivors lived in poverty. But that means that two-thirds did not, which is amazing in light of the fact that they were robbed of their families, their homes, and their years of formal education. So they went into fields that did not necessarily require a college education. So obviously, some became professionals as well. But they went into fields in which an idea, a product, a building, construction, could be the ticket to economic success. One thing that confounds Israelis is that you see in America, Hasidim, Satmar, Lubavitch, others, Babov, who are extraordinarily wealthy people, and they don't understand how is it that Haredim in America work and here not as much. But nonetheless, it exists because they went into fields, sometimes construction, real estate, other times just a product, you know, what's like 14th Street Photo, for example, in which they made a lot of money. So how could it be? How could they be so successful coming from nothing? So for sure, rags to riches stories are part of the American mythos, but survivors, I mean, those who emerged as healthy as possible, mentally and physically, were uniquely situated to take advantage of opportunities or forge their own way. They came with an acquired skill set, creative, industrious, risk takers, entrepreneurial, quick to learn, quick to adjust, and they benefited from a Jewish ethos as well. And it's not just the Matnat Hashem, which I believe in, that because they suffered so much, God bless them also, that would be appropriate. It's something else as well. Much has been written about Jewish success in business, and not all of it is intended to be anti-Jewish. If you Google Jewish business secrets, you'll come away with a wealth of information, And again, I think most of it is meant positive, not to be critical or conspiratorial. And to a great extent, this Jewish ethos and these secrets to success benefited survivors. So for example, Jews were always disproportionately, this is going back centuries already, and certainly today also, literate and numerate, meaning we knew how to read and we knew how to count, which is helpful in business. Jews have a sense of community. We know how to network with each other. It's family. Jews are competitive, but we also know how to help each other out, even rivals. For the most part, I mean, there are always exceptions, but we're happy in each other's successes. We're willing to mentor others. The brashest among us are experts in sales and marketing. It's key to success in business. And Jews especially knew how to persevere, as every business experiences a dip at some point after its founding. But Jews are resilient. We adjust, we adapt, and we move forward. We also know how to dream, but we know how to work too, and not simply fantasize about doing great things, but making our hishtadlut as well. Some say as well that Jewish ethics plays a role, that people trust Jews, all rumors to the contrary notwithstanding. The Torah promotes ethical strivings, that honest Jews, for example, as pointed out by one of the things I read, honest Jews train themselves to say Bli Neder. It's a sign that we take our word seriously, that we commit to it, but understand that there are limitations as well. Like, you want to deliver a product on time, Bli Neder, you'll make your best effort, but it's not always within your control. Even that modification shows how seriously we take our speech. And practically, of course, dishonest Jews will be shunned in business by other Jews. So dishonesty is usually bad for business. All right, sometimes we are challenged in that sphere, but I hope that it is less than other groups and not more. Obviously, we have major, major failures, but I think the names become famous and well-publicized because we're overrepresented in these fields. The truth is, for every Bernie Madoff, there are plenty of Aaron Feuersteins who continue to pay his employees after his factory burnt down, and plenty of people like a Jewish waiter who taught a busboy named Sidney Poitier how to read English, and plenty of people like the Jewish insurance company owner in North Carolina who brought in a young black, trained him, and then at a certain point said, you should have your own company, and set him up to run his own insurance company where he's successful as well. And that man today is now Senator Tim Scott from North Carolina, who is just filled with gratitude towards Jews because he came from a one-parent home, and this Jew in North Carolina just raised him up and made him a success. The best of us, and this is the other point, the best of us know that money is just a means to something. It's not an end in itself. So again, the good news is that most of the wealthy Jews I mentioned are also noted for their philanthropy. The less good news is that for most of that group, relatively little of their philanthropy goes to Jewish causes or to the Jewish people, with some notable exceptions. That's why the names of Jewish moguls adorn hospitals, museums, and foundations, but not many yeshivot. All these healthy attitudes towards money and business shape the Jewish approach and have shaped American Jewish life, or American life as well. I want to make special mention of Jewish hotel owners. Sheldon Adelson, Alva Shalom, just died a little over a year ago, was so active in Israel affairs over the years, almost a counterweight to the evil of George Soros. So Adelson owned the hotel casinos. It's worth noting, as I did once before, that Las Vegas itself was the brainchild of Jews. And not just Bugsy Siegel, Sid Wyman, Al Gottesman, Jake Gottlieb, Steve Wynn, and others. Think the Pritzker family owns the whole Hyatt chain, Ad Hayom. Jeremy Jacobs, Dan Gilbert, and many others as well. Finally, we come to banking and finance. So these were not Jewish businesses per se, but Jews became active only because other doors were very often closed to us. So the Lehman brothers, take them for example, they're religious Jews who came from Germany, came to America in the mid-19th century, one after the other, lived in Alabama, I think Montgomery, Alabama, opened up a dry goods store, parlayed that into cotton sales during the Civil War, became very wealthy, and ultimately became bankers towards the end of the century. So the Broadway play, I don't know if it's still showing, probably is. I happen to have seen it the last time I was in America, called the Lehman Trilogy. It's worth seeing. It traces the family history both in observance and success. So when the brothers each died, their children sat Shiva, 7 days. When the children died, the family sat for 3 days. When the grandchildren died, there was no Shiva at all. By the time the Lehman brothers went bankrupt in 2008, the Lehmans were long gone, although there were Jews, Richard Fuld infamously among them, who still ran the company. But when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, it was the fourth largest investment company in America after Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, and the largest investment bank, Goldman Sachs. So that itself is incredible if you think about it. Two of the four largest investment banks in America were Jewish companies, at least at their founding. So Goldman Sachs was founded in 1869 by Marcus Goldman, also born in Germany. And in his shul in Würzburg, he befriended lifelong friend Joseph Sachs, whose son Samuel Sachs married Goldman's daughter, and hence the name was changed in 1904 to Goldman Sachs. In fact, an older daughter married another son of Joseph Sachs, so Goldman and the original Sachs were mechutanim twice over. Goldman started as a peddler, and then he became a broker of IOUs. It's a risky business that nonetheless paid off. So he started relatively small, but as his capital grew, his investment bank grew as well. For almost a half century, the business was run by Goldman's and Sachs's, who just kept marrying each other. They were small rivals of another bigger banking house, J. Seligman and Company, founded by Joseph Seligman, who's another German Jewish immigrant who first made a fortune selling uniforms to the Union Army during the Civil War. It's a contract obtained by his brother William Seligman. Among other things, J. Seligman and Company became underwriters of the Transcontinental Railroad, rail construction across America, and the Panama Canal. A similar tale could be told about Felix Warburg, who joined Kuhn Loeb and Company, another 19th century bank founded by German Jews, Abraham Kuhn and his brother-in-law Solomon Loeb. And think again of the importance of community and networking, and we see how Jews succeeded. I doubt very much Morgan and Stanley were related. Loeb's son-in-law was the renowned financier Jacob Schiff, and under his leadership, Kuhn Loeb rivaled J.P. Morgan for prominence at the beginning of the 20th century. Famously, Jacob Schiff provided loans to the Japanese and thus financed the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905, and he did it because he was so angered by the Tsar's treatment of the Jews. And in fact, the Japanese routed the Russian army in a few major battles, leading to overt discontent, and then the famous riots in Russia in 1905, which is a precursor to the revolution that would take place a dozen years later. So Schiff had been raised in a religious family. He became a well-known Reformed Jew, member of Temple Emmanuel, except on his mother's yard site, at which he dafka went to say Kaddish in a regular shul. His granddaughter was Dorothy Schiff, who was a longtime owner and publisher of the New York Post. So she had the zchut, so to speak, of marrying and divorcing four Gentiles, but she did sell the New York Post to Rupert Murdoch in 1976, and that was his first American media acquisition in a major market. But Jewish involvement in finance, banking, hedge funds, and the like has only grown over the years. Names like, I'm going to miss out, I'm sure, on very famous people, but names like Stephen Schwartzman and Michael Steinhardt and Jim Simons and Carl Icahn and Ronald Perelman, Steve Cohn, now owns the Mets, Dave Tepper, Daniel Loeb. In 2020, of the top 25 hedge fund managers in America, 18 were Jews. That's incredible. And think of investment companies like David Lerner, founded by Jews. Edmund Safra may not be American, but his prominence and philanthropy in New York is well known. And it's worth mentioning in this regard as well, the prominent Jewish economic advisors to American presidents go back a little over a century. The first I could think of was really Bernard Baruch, who made a fortune in finance playing the market. He's a genius, extraordinarily talented. He always made money in the market, and somehow he had the prescience to sell his entire portfolio in 1929 before the crash, as if he saw the crash coming, and then invested after, made even more money. He advised Woodrow Wilson during World War I and became involved in logistics for America. And he advised Franklin Roosevelt in World War II. Nebuchadnezzar, he was intermarried also. But more recently, most presidents have had as their top economic advisors, meaning the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, Jews. Going back to Eisenhower's time, Arthur Burns did the same for Nixon. Martin Feldstein, Alan Greenspan, Larry Summers, Ben Bernanke, Janet Yellen. I'm not even talking about the joining the Federal Reserve Board. Larry Kudlow, sadly, as a young man converted to Catholicism, but originally a Jew. These were all economic advisors to presidents. So in that capacity, Jews have had an outsized influence on economic policy in America for the last century. And we hope it's been positive. Naturally, the prevalence of Jews in this industry and others fuels all sorts of anti-Jewish conspiracies and hatred. There's a surreal aspect to this, especially when the companies are no longer run by Jews. And when they are run by Jews, they're run by Jews far from Jewish observance. Much of it is politically driven. You know, any criticism these days of George Soros is immediately deflected by the left-wing media by accusations, oh, Jew hatred, even though Soros funds much Jew hatred and Israel hatred across the world. So I don't take that defense of him seriously at all. What I do take seriously is this. We're blessed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're blessed by God. That's the way it's supposed to be. And we were given the tools and opportunities to bring knowledge of God and goodness and morality to His world. And that is the purpose of Jewish wealth. And in many cases, in many countries, on a variety of continents, we have succeeded. We stumble also sometimes into criminality and hedonism, and we pay a price for that as well. Centuries ago, the Kliokar in Prague castigated his contemporaries for squandering their money on luxuries and thus arousing the envy and enmity of non-Jews who claim we stole it all from them. So he writes in his commentary on the Torah, it's in Dvarim Perek Bet, Pasuk Gimel, a Jew who has a certain sum of money, he flaunts it with fancy clothing and luxurious houses, as if he's very wealthy. And it just provokes, antagonizes the nations. Well, Rima Shanema Penulachem Tsafona violates, that's the pasuk in the Torah there. Tsafona, Tsafun, keep wealth hidden. Don't flaunt it. Don't advertise it. Don't boast about it. Uminog zehu berabat b'nei amenu. This custom, unfortunately, is pervasive amongst our people. V'amisabev et kol atla'a asher mitzotnu. And it generates all the travails that we're experiencing. V'hamaschilim yavinu likach musar. And those who are intelligent will learn a moral lesson from this. Well, the Kli Yakar wrote this around the year 1600. And we haven't yet internalized that lesson. But the divine gifts continue. Look at Israel, for example. Yeah, I started a nation really of refugees, nothing, food rationing. And now also there are thousands of millionaires in Israel. The products that are developed here, you know, the Waze and the camera pill, etc. It's the envy of the world. It's the envy of the Middle East. That's why Israel's standing in the Middle East has improved in the last few years. Because Arabs who don't necessarily want to kill us, they want to do business with us. And therefore, they're open to it. I'm not so sure it's love of Jews, but it is love of success. The divine gifts continue. 8 of the top 10 billionaires in the world are Americans. And 4 of them are American Jews. I'm not even counting Elon Musk, who I do not believe is a Jew. America has afforded Jews the rare opportunity in the exile to live full Jewish lives and prosper with discrimination and persecution at a minimum. It has been the land of Jewish opportunities. We should use it well. May we be blessed with the good sense to use these opportunities, l'hagdil Torah adira, for the glory of God and His Torah. That is always the test of Jewish success. I thank you very much. The series concludes next month. We'll look at the American Jewish Experience, Part 6, how we've influenced politics and religion in Jewish life. I thank you all. Erev Tov.